but it'll be twice the fun and twice the freeform. I think that's about it, so I'm going to play one PSA and then it'll be time for Living Rider, so stay tuned.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
Ozone House is the only agency in Washtenaw County providing free services to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, and questioning youth. If you need a safe and supportive space to deal with challenges presented by community, peers, or family, call Ozone House at 734-662-2222, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Ozone House offers free counseling, a weekly support group, and a weekly art and social group for LGBTQ youth. Call 734-662-2222. Ozone House. There is a safe place.
Check this out. 1, 2, 3, in the place to be, as it is plain to see, he is DJ Run, and I am DMC. Funky Fresh for 1983, DJ Jam Master J, inside the place with all the bass, he leaves without a trace, and he came here tonight to get on your case, and we are the crush grooving, the body moving, the record making, and the record breaking, and it goes a little something like this. It goes a 1, 2, 3, and here we go, here we go, here we go, here we go, here we go. DMC and DJ Run, dum diddy dum diddy diddy dum dum. We're rocking on the mic, and then you know where we're from. Dum diddy dum diddy diddy dum dum. We hope y'all ready for the big beat drum, drum diddy drum diddy diddy drum drum. So people in the place, in the big beat drum. Here it comes.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today on the program, Colson Whitehead. Colson, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
Well, it wasn't actually me.
Well, this should be the institution of the...
of WCBN,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
And do you find it much changed since your last visit here?
Well, you know, it seems to be more graffiti on the walls.
And on the table.
On the table, but it's still the same pleasant place I was 3 years ago.
Mm. We have new air ducts, so probably your lungs are perhaps happier.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think I was still smoking back then, so I was probably chain smoking a lot more. So, yeah.
Oh, so who's to even, you can't.
Yes, I have nothing to judge it with.
Right. So how's the not smoking going?
It's all right. You know, I mean, I've gone for like a year and a half before. So it's been like since the election. On November 2nd, I was like, if Obama wins, I'll quit smoking. And then he won. So that was disappointing.
But on a personal level, of course.
But I haven't smoked since then.
Well, Colson, before we go any further, I'm going to read your short bio from the back of your book, because you're here in town, you're visiting Ann Arbor with your latest novel, Sag Harbor, and this is the biography in the back. Colson Whitehead is the author of the novels The Intuitionist, a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award, John Henry Days, which won the Young Lions Fiction Award, the Anisfield Wolf Book Award, and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and Apex Hides the Hurt, a New York Times notable book and winner of the Penn Oakland Award. He has also written The Colossus of New York, a book of essays about his hometown, a recipient of a Whiting Writers Award and a MacArthur Fellowship. The genius grant, right? He lives in Brooklyn. Look at your big brain, Colson.
Well, the thing is, you know, doing the author's bio was always like sort of anxiety producing things. Cause like sometimes you're like, oh, I'm just like going on about nice things that have happened. And then so you overcompensate by being like, Colson Whitehead exists in New York City. He's a writer. And so I go between like being super terse and not giving any information and then giving too much information, but you know, so I don't know. So, but you know, the whole what's your author photo like, and that's always just a whole useless time suck, unfortunately.
Yeah, but maybe you have people who you trust that can help you with that, because sometimes we can be blind to, I don't know, these things, right?
Well, you know, with the bio, you know, and setting a thing with my author photo, definitely over the years I've made some mistakes. Like my first one, I have like you know, I look really intense, and that's because Don DeLillo's Underworld had just come out, and his author photo is like really, you know, it looks like he's gonna take a hatchet to somebody's face, and so I figured that was like what you should
look
like.
That's the look.
So you should just have this sort of psychotic stare. So that's what I was going for, with that one, and then this time. I figured I had a friend who's a photographer, and I got a professional picture done. And my publicist, at Doubleday, who never said anything about my photos, was like, "Thank God!" So, you know, that's a nice, you know, nice sort of photo we have now.
And I was looking at your website, Colson. Is it colsonwhitehead.org?
Yeah, it's counterintuitive, but it's actually that's what it is.
and on it, you kind of have these great like moments. You're quite self-effacing in them, and you say that one of the best pictures was in the New York Times recently, and you said it's from far away.
Yeah, it's a full body shot. You can't really see my face, and it's really a very lovely, well done
on the docks. It's really it is nice composition.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So anyway, we're talking about all these visual things. So let's get back to radio matters and words and fill in a little bit more of your biography. Because you were, like you mentioned, you were here 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Apex Hides the Hurt.
Yes. But I wish I'd seen those earlier author photos, because I've seen the one of you eating a hamburger, I think, online. But I have missed the Axeman photo.
It's there. It's there.
It's there. Okay. Some more digging ahead then. But so you were born in 1969.
Yes.
Sun shivers down your spine.
69 was a good year.
It was a very good year. But this book, Sag Harbor, which you're going on tour now for... it takes place in the 80s. The 80s are completely reveled in. And it seems that you're drawing a lot from your own autobiography, tapping in, perhaps, at least with, like, for example, there's a BB gun moment in the novel. So this is all fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But then in your own life story, there's a parallel moment where... Do you have a BB gun, like BB pellet in your...
Yeah, right there.
Again, we need some video feed, don't we? I can vouch for it. I see it, but I hadn't noticed it before.
Right. I guess, you know, for many years I thought I would set off alarms in, like, airports, but that didn't happen. So basically, you know, the book is called Sag Harbor, and it's about some kids from New York City who go out to this black part of the Hamptons called As You Rest in the town of Sag Harbor. And they're from the city, and they, you know, run wild in the summer. Their parents only come out on weekends, and so they're left to their own devices.
And that's normal then too for this time, because I almost found that hard to believe. That
yes, I mean, you know, that was my experience, and so that's the jumping off point. And definitely, I, you know, me and my brother, I was 15, he was 14, and we were just sort of out, left our own devices in the middle of the week. Our friend Jay, a couple blocks over, was alone too. And there were adults around. If we had to go to the hospital, someone, you know, there are people around who could take us. But it's not something that would happen now. So it seemed like a good place to start a novel. My previous books have been start off from, I guess, more intellectual propositions I wanted to explore, like problems I wanted to sort of get at. But I'd avoided writing using stuff in my personal life.
Well, how do you feel about the coming of age novels, or is that something
that... Well, I hated them growing up. Like, I didn't like Holden Caulfield. Like, I thought it was like a whiny, you know, something. And, you know,
the FCC thanks you.
Like, if I went around in my household saying, "Everybody's a phony," like, my parents would say, "And," you know, it's like, yeah, we told you, you know, when you were two, that everyone's a phony. So I could never relate to Catcher in the Rye. And when I realized I wanted to write about Sag Harbor and the summer of 85, I didn't want to inject like the sort of fake melodrama where like the kids find a body and then like Stand By Me starts playing, or like there are two kids on a branch and the one kid shakes the branch, the other kid dies. And
that's your book in 10 years from now when everything's going to...
Yeah, so I didn't want to do like fake, you know, fake action like Jaws or whatever. So I wanted to try and elevate these small, mundane personal moments to the stuff of fiction, of art. So, first crappy, like, how can I narrate the first crappy job, first kiss, a BB gun fight and make it transcend its quotidian origins and become, you know, a worthwhile story.
But could that also be what's also important about it, because that there's a genuineness there that's a different type of depth?
Well, I think, you know, when people can relate to it, people relate to it because it is ordinary. There's not some sort of life-changing, transcendent moment. It's really a sort of, you know, I think we're a collection of small moments that change us over time, and I wanted to sort of narrate that. You know, the main character,
and so
Benji.
That was in your head, Coulson, when you like, how did this project actually begin? Was it something that you just because you went back to Sag Harbor and there was something about like that, those memories or those things that you look at something but you see the layers behind it, or like what started the project for you?
Well, yeah, I hadn't gone out to Sag Harbor for a long time because I went to college, and then it was like too, you know, Hamptons are too bougie. I don't want to be out there. You know, I'm a hipster. But then just started visiting my mother, who moved out there full time, and renting my aunt's place. It's just a nice, mellow place. And so I'd have friends out, and each time I would try to tell them, like, that's so-and-so's house, or that's the kid who used to beat me up, and then my sister beat him up, and then his mother beat up my mother. Like, the stories just kept getting more and more extravagant, and I realized that there was such a history of to the place, and it hadn't been told. People didn't really know about this black community in the Hamptons, and the fact that we were left on our own was sort of like a good proposition to move from. So I wanted to write about it, and then I had to figure out how to structure it. And since there isn't this, you know, a strong linear plot, the idea is that the voice, you know, Benji's voice and Benji's perspective are enough of a, provide enough narrative propulsion to pull you through.
I didn't, I asked the publishers, but I wasn't able to get the books in time, like to have like more of a scope of your work. And you're right, I could have gone to the library.
You're unprepared, but that's okay. Life is
hey,
short.
Look at all this paper.
Yeah, you're very prepared.
Yeah, thanks. But coming, so I read about you,
mm-hmm,
right,
yeah,
in the prep of things, but not the actual getting the sense of the words themselves. But when I came,
the actual primary sources.
Yes, your primary sources.
No, it's different. I mean, it's you know.
The project seemed vastly different, but it seems like something that almost, in a weird way, coming of age as a writer, where you felt more solid about some sort of, not voice, because this is obviously a different voice than what would have been coming before. But do you think that's why this book is possible now, rather than your first book that's based on autobiography?
Well, yeah, I mean, the cliche is that your first book is, you know, drawn very directly from your personal experience. And I was so self-conscious when I started writing in the 90s. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to do like the Gen X novel where like it opens with like Kurt Cobain's death and you're coming to grips and like, you know, that sort of thing, which is going on, which is sort of common in the mid 90s. So I started off being more oddball and, you know, figuring out how to talk about race or technology and culture in different ways. So through elevator inspectors. That's weird. Through John Henry days.
Otis.
Like,
yeah.
So, and now, you know, definitely I hated adolescence and I found it excruciating just to think about it. So it took 20 years to be able to sort of process it and figure out what I could use from it that would serve a story. And then just technically, whenever I tried a first-person voice for a full book, it always ended up lapsing to my own voice. And so it took, you know, 5 books in to be able to have a first-person narrator for 300-something pages that was a character and not some version of, you know, not myself, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes, I do. And so 300 pages or so.
Well, how does it turn out? I mean, I guess when I handed it in, it was like 350. Now it's 270. But, you know, yeah.
That is so actually there was a moment where at some point you realized it had, like, the character Benji had morphed into not being some cusp of you then.
Well, you know, I mean, if I could have used like more of myself, I mean, you know, my experiences are in there. So I worked in an ice cream store for 3 summers.
Big Olaf.
But I did not have like a racist incident with my boss and then try and sabotage like his freezers. So, I mean,
right.
I did try to add something to my uninteresting life. Like, my friends aren't that interesting and I'm not interesting. So I have to make up things that happened. So
the way of the writer.
Yes.
The observer.
I mean, I would love to do some sort of memoir where...
By the way, you seem very interesting, Coulson.
Thank you. On radio, you know, people can't see me. I'm not sure what that means.
And his his boring hand gestures.
You know, I wanted to say basic character on my friend John, but each time John appeared, he would do something un-John-like because the overriding purpose is to serve the story, and so I'd have to change things. And so each time he appears or opens his mouth or walks onto the chapter, he's doing something unlike my friend because there's a higher purpose. And so, while, you know, when I was organizing the book, I thought, oh, and here's the you know, my friend Billy. But it didn't work out that way.
And were people sort of, those friends, were they disappointed? Did they want to see more of, or do they see themselves in the book?
Well, you know, I mean, all those guys I hung out with I haven't seen in a long time. Some of them still go out to Sag Harbor, but, or different times. You know, I'm only out there for 3 weeks. So the book's been out, you know, for a few weeks, and I haven't heard from them. So we'll see what they think.
We'll see. All right, well, let's take a short break. You're listening to Living Writers. Today on the program, Coulson Whitehead. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front stoop, hanging out the window, watching all the cars go by.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, you've got Living Writers here. And today on the program, Coulson Whitehead. He's in town with his latest novel, Sag Harbor. And a quick shout out. Thanks, Alex Belhodge, for engineering so nicely today, as always. So Coulson, in The New Yorker, I think when you, like, when you burst onto the scene, I think, I don't have the date here, but John Updike called you ambitious and scintillating.
That's very nice of him.
Yeah. How does it feel to be scintillating?
Well, you know, I mean, I think there's, like, you know, my private self, which is 95%, you know, in my house, walking around, working, is where I work and live, and I'm just sort of padding around in my dirty pajamas, surfing the web.
Not trying to be scintillating.
Not trying to be scintillating. And then, you know, then your book comes out and it's out into the world and people have responses to it and you talk about it. And sometimes you understand what they're saying, sometimes you don't. But it's all very, you know, it's all very separate and external. Like, there's no sort of, there's a real disconnect between what comes out in the press and, like, what is actually going on with the process and how you live every day, you know.
Yeah, so when the book is in the world, in a marketing sense, like when it's out there, rather than when you just finish it or you've made the story, then that's a different part of you that's called upon to be out there sort of getting the word out. I like your YouTube clip, though. I thought that was smart.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, in the age of...
It's a brief tour of Sag Harbor. Coulson walks you around, so you can check that out on YouTube if you
want. Yeah, my publisher was like, oh, the new thing is YouTube. And so they sent a film crew out. Well, this one guy, and he maybe walked around and did like a four-minute video, which is interesting because, you know, my first book came out in 99, and I did some small videos like BarnesandNoble.com, and they were trying out different things, like weird, like, promo videos, but at that point there was no common platform. So things were like Real Player or this was QuickTime, and that was a sort of, you know, became a sort of flop because just because you go to Barnes & Noble doesn't mean you have Real Player and yada yada. And so, I've been around, it's only been 10 years, but it's been cool to see how the promo thing changes.
Well, because almost everyone has a website now, right?
People have websites. And then, like, so it's a promo video and it seems new, but we were doing them 10 years ago. It's just now there's a common platform, and so everyone can see them. You don't have to download something for 20 minutes on your modem in order to play it. And so the same thing's going on, but it's a different time.
Is it interesting to you as a writer? Like, do you ever look at the feedback? Because, of course, with YouTube, for example, then there's, of course, all the comments. And so to see what people say, or, that could seem poisonous after a while. Or in the good or bad way.
There's YouTube comments. There's, like, blog comments. There's comments on Amazon. So you have to figure out, like, what you can handle. Because you get, like, some stinker, and it's just there for, like, years. And it's there forever, frankly. And what are you going to do, like, have a flame war with some guy on Amazon or YouTube? So you have to, like, learn to keep your distance, and if you're going to be curious, be prepared that someone's going to give you one star and say, this guy's a joker.
Right. But you're not.
I'm not a joker.
In fact, in the book, I was wondering, going back to Sag Harbor, which in a little while we'll hear a piece from. It's when you're in the book, at least my experience felt like it was in some ways like a very quiet book, but the things were building, but it was a quiet, it's like a being there with these characters. But I did notice there are moments where there's these allusions to maybe some of the friends, like a friend dying, or because when, for example, we've talked about the BB gun, that there's this episode in the book, and then there's it kind of connects to that or it's hinted at that a couple of the friends don't come out, much later on, not that summer of 85, but can you talk about that? Like, was that conscious, that that element of, I don't know, and there's darkness with the family where there's the violence, it feels like the undercurrent, and do you want to talk about that
a little bit? I mean, there's not a conventional plot, but there is sort of, obviously forward movement. Some of it is seasonal, we're being pulled through the summer. And some of it is just, getting more of a full idea of who these people are, who the parents are. So the parents don't really appear that much until chapter 5. Then we get a full-on sort of dose in the, I guess what I always called the barbecue from hell chapter.
I was surprised that at the, like, when he finally, when, when Benji gets to eat some of it, I thought it would be different.
Right. In terms of the BB, the narrator is an adult looking back on his childhood. And for me, I couldn't have done a 15-year-old voice for 300 pages. I would have gone crazy. So I needed an adult perspective, organizing his life and making this sort of raw material and shaping it and having a sort of critical perspective on it. And so he does have this knowledge of stuff that's after the summer, where people are going. And
is that why I wondered about, because I was read that it said that there was someone had asked you about, had you intended a young adult category for it? And that was one of those moments where you did respond to them, because that sort of went out of proportion, it seemed to me, that, like, where someone had said that you were upset by that, and I liked your
it's like some completely random blogger was like, Colson White had got huffy when someone asked him if his book should be marketed as YA, and then, like, another blogger who writes a lot about stuff on the web about books, like, can you care to comment? And so it was like a mini scandal about nothing. And at the conference, I was just like, I don't do marketing. I'm a writer. You can go to the marketing panel if you want to talk about marketing. I don't, think about about that end of things.
And then they took that as sort of a rebuff or something, that you thought there was something wrong with the YA or, but I wondered when you were talking about the voice, if that doesn't have something to do with it, because it's not as if you're writing, as if it's this 15-year-old voice that keeps, there's this this other presence.
Yeah, there. I mean, people cheat. They'll have, like, a really precocious, genius 12-year-old narrator, and that's how they get around the fact that the limited perspective. And so it's a precocious, child prodigy who's narrating, who's a 12-year-old narrating. That's not, most of us aren't prodigies when we're 15 we're just like numbskull teenagers. And so I do want to talk about numbskullness, but I don't want to have it articulated in the words of a numbskull.
Right.
So,
or be at the steering wheel of the book, sort of.
Yeah, yeah. So there's that.
But the darkness of the family, because I sort of took you away from that, like those.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's just, you know, adding a new layer. You know, you set
well,
a baseline.
Tension.
And it's tension. You create a baseline of what the summer's about. And then each chapter, I want to sort of ramp up the dysfunction a little bit. That's what I was thinking. And so it's, you know, two chapters of setup, and then we meet Benji, and then he does something in an ice cream parlor, and that's like one sort of twist on his character, because he's been a certain way for 100 pages, and then he does an action that perverts that. And the next chapter is the BB gun fight, which is a rehearsal for later kind of fights. I think I picked 85 because I was a teen then, and I know it. But also, you know, the kids love pop culture, so the films and music they love are play a big part, and hopefully can talk about larger things. And so 85, hip-hop is still kind of corny. It has, like, there are groups like UTFO who dress like the Village People. They have characters, and they're really corny. But 5 years later from then, you're going to have Ice Cube and NWA, and the music is commercialized, gangsterized, and these kids, and they sort of, the innocence of the music is gone. In the same way that the boys who are 15 in 85 will be in their late teens and in a couple of years, and they'll be young black men and targets and have a whole different negotiation with the world. And so the sort of...
But there's also, you have some of that negotiation in their lives right now, because there's moments where, and it's not like you're, you know, getting the 2x4 out by any means. It's like, it's sort of chilling, because it'll be, because one of the friends will have a car. Like, so he gets to be, you know, kind of big cheese, and they all go with him in the car. But there's this idea of, well, you don't go too far, because something, I wish I had the page actually, but because something racial might happen.
Yeah, you don't go out of your territories.
You don't know where the exits are, something.
Yeah.
Where
I
you
mean,
just think, oh.
Yeah, I mean, they're, you know, Sag Harbor.
Because there's the beach community idea where you think, well, oh no, everything must be okay for everyone here, because sometimes there's this illusion that class economics or something then changes some racial tension. I don't know.
Yeah. I know what you're saying. I mean, just because in the Hamptons, it's not all rosy. I mean, what do you call a black man with a PhD? The N-word. I mean, it's like, you know, no matter what, you know, that's like an old joke from Malcolm X. don't be shocked.
I know. Apparently I'm whiter than ever right now, right? Oh, God.
So, yeah, no, if they strayed, you know, if we strayed out of Sag Harbor and we didn't know what was up, we did have sort of paranoid fantasies. I mean, we are still targets in this mostly white part of the island. And if we do end up going up the wrong street in Southampton, you know, the cops will follow us. You know, it's so.
And you, there's a moment also, a subtle moment on the beach where, like, he's, because they can see the beach from the house, and there's people who were tourists and obviously not residents, but then they came down and walking along the beach, and then they realized that they were around people that didn't look like them, so they kind of turned around again. So
yeah, yeah, I mean, just, you know, the folks in the book have their own beach, and it's all black, but, you know, this white tourist will stroll down, and then suddenly they'll sort of realize, oh, you know, everyone's looking at me, and turn back. And the same thing happens when the kids go to the white beach, the Southampton or East Hampton. They're the only black bodies on the beach, and they realize that the same sort of scanning out from the decks of the beach houses that they did on their black beach is happening to them, except there's white people watching them also. And so, you know, you stray out of your territory, and your subject becomes object, and object becomes subject. You know?
I feel like I keep taking you away also from that aspect. You said, so each chapter, like, things are becoming slightly more ramped up or dysfunctional even. And
I mean, like, you create effects by juxtaposition. And so if you have a childhood caper, which has elements of
childhood caper. That's great.
Of the sinister, and then you sort of expand upon that sort of darkness in the next chapter. And then, you know, you have the caper where they try to get into the club. And so you have a really dark chapter, and then you juxtapose it with a more sort of light chapter. And I think that evokes the dissociation that's going on. Because, like, you know, Benji is sort of aware of what's going on with his family, but not totally. And he's sort of in denial of, like, his family dysfunction. And so in the same way that that kind of personality retreats into ignoring what's going on, the book is sort of ignoring the darkness of the dysfunction of the family and going into this sort of more lighter thing about getting into a club and trying to see Lisa Lisa and Grandma and UTFO. And so, you know, hopefully, you know, I'm manipulating the reader's mood, you know, and that's my way of moving us forward and changing up the rules of the book from chapter to chapter, if that makes sense.
It does. But it does seem like that the voice or the perspective of is aware of that level of I don't know, like something that's just almost like with the interactions with the mom and dad, where and then the Reggie finds a note that the mother has sketched out, like yells at me in front of my friends, or these things, like you just think, oh, you know, there's so much.
And they're not really commented on. I mean,
or that the sister is not there because she doesn't want to be there. Not just because it's too bougie or
bougie.
Okay, well, let's take a short break and I'll have some elocution lessons here. You're listening to Living Writers. I'm Dee Hetzel. Today, Colson Whitehead and his novel Sag Harbor. We'll be back.
Yo, EMD.
Yeah, what's up, man?
Think of that girl they call Roxanne. She's all stuck up.
Why you say that?
Cause you wouldn't give a guy like me no rap. But she was walking down the street, so I said, hello, I'm Kango from the TFO. And she so, I said, so, baby, don't you know I can sing a rap dance in just one show? Cause I'm Kango, Mr. Sophisticator. As far as I know, ain't nobody greater. From beginning to end and to beginning, I never knew because I'm all about winning. But if I was to lose, I wouldn't be the same. Cause I'm not a gambler, I don't bet. I don't be in no casino, and baby, playing nizzo. The is-I is the grizzly, kiss ain't kizzo. I thought you'd be impressed and give me devious rap. I thought I had a goal inside my sin in the trap. I thought it'd be a piece of paper, there was nothing like that. I guess that's what I give a think, it ain't that right, black. I thought I had it in the palm of my hand. But man, no man, if I was grand, I'd bang Roxanne.
Roxanne, Roxanne,
can't you understand?
Roxanne, Roxanne,
I wanna be your man. Yo, Kango, I don't think that you're dense, but you went about the matter with no experience. You should know, she doesn't need a guy like you. She needs a guy like me with a high IQ. And she'll take to my rap, cause my rap's the best. The educated rapper MD will never fess. So when I met her, I wasted no time, but stuck up Roxanne, paid me no mind. She thought my name was Barry, I told her it was Gary. She said she didn't like it, so she chose to call me Barry. She said she loved to marry my baby, she would carry. And if we had a baby, we'd name the baby Harry. Her mother's name is Mary, which is really quite contrary. Her face is very hairy, and you can say it's scary. She doesn't not hairy, our father's a fairy. His wife's a secretary, his son's a memorary. Back in January, or was it February? But every time I say this rhyme, it makes me kind of weary. It's only customary to get this commentary. You never find a rhyme like this in any dictionary.
Obviously.
Welcome back. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today Colson Whitehead, reading from Sag Harbor very soon.
Yeah, you can say MOFO, right? Like mofo?
Oh,
like,
yes,
yeah,
yes,
yeah. I wouldn't say the, say the real, yeah.
Because it's, yeah, syllables, so. Yeah. That seems fine. Nice.
Excellent.
Not that. I was going to say we should have sign language, and I was like, well, we do, I guess.
Yeah, there's a review on Amazon. It's like, I like the book, but it's a little rough on the language. But I guess, you know, in terms of like the profanity, because like they curse a lot, the kids.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of profanity. So I guess it was like some, you know, older person who didn't.
That's true. I was like, I think I must hang out with hooligans then. I was like, what? Really?
Yeah. It's just, I mean, it's a standard seven words you can't say on TV, but.
Right.
On radio. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's see. Well, yeah, so Sag Harbor, we should mention that you're here in town for Bookfest.
Yes.
Colson, and tomorrow, well.
Is it airing tonight?
We're on Wednesdays. No, I wish it was live. That would be great. But it's Wednesdays, so we're in a time warp right here. But,
so I was in town, yeah.
And
although I get, yeah.
Now we're completely confused. Where are we? Who are we?
Yeah, the Bookfest. I'm excited. It should be fun.
Yes.
Today was the writer's conference, so I did a talk about the writer's craft.
The crafty writers.
Yes.
I like that you had a title of an essay that was, wow, fiction works.
Well, yeah, I mean, because I get invited to do, like, serious craft talks at colleges and stuff, but I have nothing to say, so I do fake lectures making fun of the idea of writing, or not taking it as seriously. So whenever I do a talk about writing, it's like a parody. So how to write a memoir, you know, what is a poem?
I liked your how to read paragraph too. That was good.
Yes, like close reading. Like, if you know how to read, I mean, I'm reading this, so obviously you can't. Yeah, so.
But you said your intellectual coming of age was at Oxford?
Oh, well, that was a character.
Nice. Be careful when you look at things in pieces.
Yeah, that piece was sort of making fun of certain critics who are very leery of postmodernism and, the Zadie Smiths, the Jonathan Franzens of the world who are, you know, it was a James Wood parody.
That's an example of
an example
what
of my
you're
fake
up to.
Craft, yeah, okay. My fake craft talks, yeah.
And then is there a question session afterwards or
yes, and then I'm serious, you know. Then,
okay.
Yeah.
That must be pretty good. You're almost like the Stephen Colbert of the craft talk circuit.
Well, yeah,
then.
I mean, that's I mean, I think sometimes people get upset or that, you know, they take notes for the first 2 minutes and they're like, oh man, and then they get into it, you know.
Well, can we hear a bit of Sag Harbor then?
Surely, surely. Okay. So, I mean, it's self-explanatory. I picked 85, and then 1985 is the setting, and I had to figure out what would work in the book. And so it turns out that this horrible event happened, and here we go. A few weeks earlier, the Coca-Cola company had discontinued their signature cola. They'd lost market share to Pepsi. Diet Coke, the sister brand, had been too successful, luring away consumers with the promise of thinner thighs, a figure more in line with that aerobicized you. The higher-ups hit upon a catastrophic solution. They decided to replace the most famous drink in the world with an imposter. I've been addicted to Coke for years with a 2 or 3 can a day habit since the 5th grade, starting around the same time my schoolmates started stealing. Shoplifting, now that I think about it. When my sister told me not to be so hyper, or my parents told me to knock it off, I vibrated with the strain of keeping still and wondered why nature had cursed me so. It wasn't until I was in high school that I learned what caffeine was. My love for Coke went beyond mere buzz, however. How could one not be charmed by the effervescent joviality of a tall glass of the stuff, the manic activity of the bubbles, popping, reforming, popping anew, sliding up the inside of the glass to freedom, as if the beverage were, miraculously, caffeinated on itself? That tart first sip, preferably with the ice knocking against the lips for an added sensory flourish, that stunned the brain into total recall of pleasure, all the Cokes consumed before, and all those impending Cokes, the long line of satisfaction underpinning a life. What forgiveness for the supreme disappointment of a fountain Coke that turned out to be fizzless and dead, or a lukewarm Coke that had been sitting for a while, falling away from its ideal temperature of 46.5 degrees Fahrenheit / 8 degrees Celsius. All the bubbles fled so that it had become a useless mud of sugar, which is what new Coke tasted like, actually. I remember when I first heard they were changing the formula. April 23rd, 1985. It was dinner time, and I'd wandered into the living room to ask my mother a question. I can't remember what it was, as it was erased by the terrible information. I walked in just in time to hear the newscaster say, "A surprising announcement about an American classic." And somehow I knew. I stayed through the commercial break and watched as Roberto Gozieta, the CEO of Coca-Cola, cheered the end of the world. It was inconceivable, like tampering with the laws of nature. Hey, let's try gravity-free Tuesdays. Buckle up, mofos. From this day on, water is incredibly flammable. Let's see how that goes. I slunk back into my room, dizzy and confused. It was as if someone had popped the top of the world, and let all the air out. Within days, I'd cornered the market, the local market on Old Coke in a grid defined by 106th to the north, 96th Street to the south, and from Amsterdam to the river, buying up what I could from the corner bodegas, the increasingly slick delis popping up on Broadway, and the assorted stationery stores of the hood. By the time New Coke started to appear, a few days after the announcement, I was well prepared, with a huge stash in my closet, a prayer against doomsday. I had no dreams of profiteering, of selling my stock at a dear price to aficionados when the day came when the people of Earth discovered the treasure they destroyed. As if the cola were an exquisite lizard or spiny bivalve, driven to extinction in a race's savage drive to ruin. No, I wanted it all to myself, like an art thief who steals new descending a staircase or some key Picasso and hangs it on the wall of his own private gallery for his wicked and ingrown pleasure, at peace with the fact that the world is unaware of his activities, and perhaps that is actually the point of the entire exercise. Although such a sentiment is probably not too surprising coming from a boy whose main recreation was masturbation.
Thank you, Coulson. That's great about the Coke. I don't think I've ever heard anyone write about it, and that was just right on.
I love Coke.
You can tell it comes through.
Well, yeah, you got to write what you know. So.
Right, exactly. For it to be authentic.
Yes.
To me. So that's one of the very real parts of the book. So is it always that in your other writing, are you also always using, because there's so much humor in that too, such an attention to this minute detail, and I don't know, with that voice, it seemed like such a great, you just start to, like, that was one of the moments where I just really loved the main character, where I just thought these obsessions and, like, that almost a vulnerability, and then what this leads to is, yeah, like, his one of, yeah, his first big slip-ups, right?
So, well, I think, you know, his voice, I mean, I generally like to have some sort of form of humor in my books, and this voice definitely accommodates a lot of different types of humor, the silliness about the message by Grandmaster Flash, or, like, you know, this, these sort of comic asides. So, you know, with this narrator, I was able to let it rip. With a book like The Intuitionist, where I am mostly playing it straight, and the main character is very sort of repressed, and it's a fake detective novel, so the language, the sentences are very clipped. I can't have this sort of broad humor, and where there is humor, it's deadpan. You know, it's making fun of the premise that there are elevator inspectors who are important and have, like, beats and, like, ride around like cops. So the humor is different, but that's a very important component of how I see the world and, you know, and how I, you know, construct my narratives. In terms of, like, you know, that close zoom in, yeah, I mean, that's, like, a feature of my writing, just, like, getting... no matter what it is, like the sort of insane close-up on
46.7 degrees how cold the Coke is.
Making it real and zooming in as close as I can without sort of destroying the illusion, but having a lot of fun with breaking something down and figuring out how it works.
And so I think it is actually funny that, because I asked Coulson to read this part, so he humored me. Thank you. But it's funny that I was wanting us to talk about sort of the darker elements, like some of the pathos or the tension, and then I kind of give us this comedic interlude. Was it harder to write these moments in this book because there weren't maybe those, even if it's not like the, you know, like those moments with the elevators where it's, you're making these things up and they're important on their beats, and was this a, yeah, was it, I guess, was it harder or easier? I don't mean that. What a terrible question.
They're always hard. They're always hard in different ways. And so with The Intuitionist, I was learning how to write a linear narrative. With John Henry Days, I was trying to figure out how to do a book with a decentralized character and sort of structure. And with this, I was trying to figure out how to make these mundane moments into an interesting story. And so each book has its own problems you got to figure out.
But what surprised you about the writing of this book that you couldn't have anticipated? Because it's sort of something you felt like you could do it now. You were ready to risk like this, at least like a setting of adolescence. Mm-hmm. And well, you know, so what surprised you?
Whether or not these disclosures are true, you know, Benji's emotional disclosures or psychological disclosures are true to my life or not. I do have to dig deep in order to get them out there. And so I decided early on that I was going to be just like do the full Monty. And even though it's going to be incredibly draining and excruciating, you know, describe what it is to be a horribly awkward teenager. Describe, you know, trying to make out with somebody. Describe, you know, some horrible parental dysfunction that you're embroiled in and can't escape. And so once I committed to doing it and doing it the best way I could, you know, that was like the challenge. And it was also fun and it was, you know, exhilarating. And it was very different than, you know, some. I mean, I've had moments like that in other parts of my book where I'm doing, getting to some sort of emotional chapter that evokes in a response to me as like a writer and as a person. And it happened a lot more with this book.
Sort of revelations then, yeah. In some way.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? We'll take a break and we'll come back. We'll come back for more revelations from Colson Whitehead. His novel, Sag Harbor. I'm T. Hetzel. You're listening to Living Writers. We'll be back soon. Welcome back. You're listening to Living Writers. Today on the program, Colson Whitehead and with his novel, Sag Harbor. And that was the Smiths.
Yes, the Smiths, the lovely Smiths.
And the 80s. you were denigrating the 80s on the YouTube clip where you were saying maybe the 70s possibly could be worse.
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about it. Like, what was worse, the 70s or the 80s? They're both sort of atrocious. To different degrees,
but yet we circle back to honor them, like, you know, especially in LA where they flash back to 80s fashion kind of regularly now, like every few years it seems.
Whenever like in college, like the Artie dorm had like an 80s party like on January 1st, 1990. I mean, I think we go back to the 80s, you know, our favorite periods pretty quickly now. I mean, we're cycling through. So I mean, I liked whatever, like 4 years ago when the whole electro clash thing happened, or 5 years ago, 7 years ago, when like early new wave stuff was coming. Yeah. And so now I feel like early new wave is back again. I see all these crazy kids walking around Brooklyn, you know, dressed like they're walking out of a Devo video. And so, but that, they're doing that like 7 years ago. So we just keep cycling through over and over again.
Yeah, almost like when Interpol came out with their first album, it was like, oh, great, because there was something so very familiar, even though, you know, doing it in their own way, of course. But it was like having a Coke, a classic Coke.
Sure. I mean, I felt like, you know, the boomers were in such ascendancy for a long time that, you know, they came of age in the 60s, and that they've been in control of the mass media, you know, and the means of cultural production for so long. But now people in their 30s and 40s are taking over, and instead of having, like, you know, the inevitable annual documentary about the summer of love, and, you know, it was a time of joy. It was a time of fringe vests, you know, and they put on, like, one pill makes you, like, they always play the same Jefferson Airplane song. So how many times do you have to celebrate the summer of love? So I figure with this, you know, the people who grew up in the 70s and 80s are now are taking the reins of cultural production, and we're going to have, like, our Star Wars, you know, we're going to pay homage to Star Wars, you know, until the people who grew up in the 90s take over. So, but now it's our time to go back to the 80s and force it down the throats of people older and younger than us.
Yes. Hallelujah. So was it in the 80s, though, when you first decided, you know, I'm a writer? Did you ever have that idea, or was it just something you always did, or
something? I mean,
because it said that you liked comic books, and
yeah, I mean, I think I remember, like, reading the Chris Claremont, John Byrne X-Men, like, in 81, and being like, oh, this would be a good job. And all my friends who now write either want to draw or write, like, the X-Men or mm-hmm. Spider-Man. So
and Stephen King,
you know, like, I loved, like, Carrie and Salem's Lot and The Shining, and until I got to college, I thought I would, you know, I would write, like, the Black Shining or the Black Salem's Lot. If you took, like, a Stephen King novel and put, like, the black in front of it, like, that's what I wanted to do. And then I started reading the modernists and stuff like that, and that was, like, a different sort of take on things, but.
Right. I guess I haven't thought of that, like, the Black Shining.
Why not? You know, well, in the 70s, you know, with the rise of, I was teaching a class on great moments in Black existentialism, which is unfortunate because I always stumble on the word existentialism, but I had to say it also, like, 10 times a class, so that was really awkward. But I did a thing on, like, the gangster pose and, like, Blaxploitation, and so, you know, I assumed, like, all the kids who were 18 and 19 had some familiarity with Blaxploitation, but of course they didn't because they were born in 1982 or whatever.
So did you bring, like, Shaft in and, like,
I made them watch Shaft and Superfly, and then I showed them YouTube trailers of, like, all the black horror movies. So Blackenstein, Scream, Blackula, Scream, the original Blackula. Abby was a ripoff of The Exorcist with it was a black exorcist, and it was called Abby. There weren't any Black Wolfman movies, but there was, like, you know, I found the trailer for The Thing with Two Heads, which is Ray Milland, you know, the actor. His head is transplanted onto the body of Rosie Grier, who's a prisoner who's volunteered for this experiment. But then, Ray Milland is a racist, so when he wakes up and he's attached to Rosie Grier, comedy ensues. You know, he looks at, you know, Rosie Grier, like, whips out his junk, and, like, he's like, you know, big penis jokes. And then, like, he's having sex with his lady, and Ray Milland is, like, you know, having a confused response. And I saw it, I remember seeing it as a kid, and you can say junk on, you can say junk.
Existential junk.
I remember seeing it at a Blaxploitation festival at the Film Forum in New York a couple years ago. And this is really off topic, but they filmed a 2-minute car chase sequence and then literally looped it for 15 minutes. And so you see the same, like, cars jumping off from the same angle over and over again. And it just goes on forever. Like, they ran out of, you know, there was not much of a plot to go on with originally.
But a decent score.
Yes, the score was great. And then this 20-minute car chase, which is, like, how long, like, they really just didn't care. It was a different time.
Yeah, and maybe you went into the theater with different, not just popcorn. Who knows?
Well, yes, no, definitely.
So it was really, maybe you didn't notice that it was the same
some
car
Coke.
Jumping.
Went in with some Coke, some classic
right,
Coke.
Some classic Coke, exactly. So when you were a kid, did you, like, write in a journal, or were you starting to sketch out comics, or what?
Well, I remember, like, my friends and I had a Mad magazine ripoff called Cheapo, but because
Cheapo,
it was called Cheapo, okay. And But we only did like Star Wars parodies, and so like it was our dream to perfect the Star Wars parody, and so it'd be like cheapo, you know, issue two, you know, back to Star, like, you know, Star Wars.
What,
like,
would be an example of a sketch that you would?
I can't even remember. Just like, you know, like
something with Princess Leia, no doubt, and her buns.
Not even. Oh, that, you know, that was, yeah, you know, it was like second, you know, third grade, and so it was all about like Darth, you know. We had a kid who could draw Darth Vader. It was all about what you could draw really well, and so that became the basis for any joke. If you couldn't draw Obi-Wan Kenobi, you wouldn't have any Obi-Wan Kenobi jokes. So it was all like Darth Vader heads and TIE fighters, like those. So a lot of that with, like, I think Thought Bubbles coming out. You know, I'm not really sure. I can't, you know, right. I don't have any copies of it, but.
Well, that's a shame.
Yes.
Because that would be some. So it was sometime. So did you come to, like, writing more as a reader first, like finding some sort of, or is it just like, it actually, when you were talking about the Stephen King, it sounded maybe like you were intrigued by the actual, his construction. Because with King, you can kind of see some things, that not in a bad way, but what some things that are at work.
Well, I remember reading Carrie in seventh grade.
And
like,
you deconstruct things very well. Like, you just, like, how you talk about your own work and, yeah.
But, well, Carrie, you know, has, it's been a long time, but he has, like, newspaper reports of, like, the day Carrie goes crazy interspersed before the day of the prom. And so, like, there's this structural element, which is reportage of this impending event, and we sort of get sketchy details before. And I was like, oh, like, why is this news report here? And, like, that, you know, that's sort of, like, you know,
oh,
kind
can
of
you do that?
Junior Pomo in Carrie. And, these sort of extra textual elements that he introduced. And I remember thinking, oh, you know, I didn't put it this way, but, oh, you make, there's a different effect from when you get this foreshadowing in, this sort of sketchy foreshadowing, and that creates a different way of reading the story. So I remember, like, thinking, oh, it's cool that he's doing this different sort of horror story.
When you were at the Village Voice for 2 years, did that give you some time to start, to like be a writer, or did you take that job because you already sort of, you know, fancied yourself a writer?
all those things. I mean, I took it because I read The Voice and loved it, and I wanted to be one of these sort of like free range cultural dudes who writes about TV in the morning and Derrida at night or whatever, deconstructing hip hop and stuff like that. But I saw myself as a fiction writer primarily, but I didn't actually write fiction. I wasn't very good at it, and I didn't actually write anything. It was journalism. When I was at The Voice for, like, you know, 5 years, having to produce, having to sit down for 5 hours and learning how that attention span, being following a deadline so that you can get paid, so that you can have money to go out. And so I learned a lot of good habits. Also, it's a public forum, so if you write a great article, people are like, oh, congratulations. In a dud article, you hear nothing. So I learned, you know, what if I was being too self-indulgent, you know, not to do it next time, do more of this next time because you get more positive affirmation. So like five years of doing that, I was freelance, and the freelance lifestyle gave me enough time to do fiction. Like, I can't write if I have a full-time job. I teach occasionally, but if I have to teach, I can't write. So I need like a whole day free to get stuff done.
And so do you have like a first novel that's in a drawer? Like what you always like, that stereotypical drawer that's out there that we all have apparently?
Yeah, it's about, because I didn't want to do something autobiographical, I decided to do something that was probably drew more from my journalism critical work. And so it was about a Gary Coleman-esque child star who grows up and is abused by a mass media combine. And so I wrote this thing, it was very good. And then I was surprised that a book about a Gary Coleman-esque child star wouldn't find its footing in the marketplace. So that...
I shouldn't laugh.
I was shocked. No one else was shocked.
I would think the film would already be options or whatever.
But I learned my lesson, so I started writing about elevator inspectors. And that
Maybe it's good to... Yeah, it sure did. Oh, geez. Like, listing the, like, so many prizes and accolades, but maybe you'll unlearn that lesson, because I think there should be, you know, a Gary Coleman-esque child star novel.
There is. In my drawer.
In your drawer.
Yeah.
Well, maybe there's a sequel.
Yes, there could be a sequel.
Well, thanks for telling us what's in your drawer, Colson Whitehead.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
And thanks for being here today. And you've been listening to Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, we've been lucky to have Colson Whitehead here with his book, Sag Harbor. Thanks for listening, Ann Arbor. Thanks for streaming. Thanks to Alex Belhodge. Until next time.
Smile, I suppose it's very nice. Put a step to your left and a flick to the right. You catch that barrel way out west. You know you're something special and you look like you're the best. Her name is Rio and she dances on the sand. She's like that.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, February 6, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, gun safety advocates call for congressional action on background checks and a ban on certain types of guns and ammunition after House lawmakers introduce a bill to crack down on gun trafficking. Scientists raise concern about a Department of Energy plan to recycle scrap metal from nuclear facilities. And we'll speak to a West Papuan tribal leader about the struggle for independence and his own exile from the region.
Even myself, when I was in prison, they want to kill me 3 times. So that's why I managed to escape and I came to United Kingdom.
Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Muslim leaders in Cameroon made a surprising statement today condemning female genital mutilation. This comes as the world observes an international day opposing the practice. FSRN's Gala Kilian Chimtum reports from Yaounde.
Minister of Women's Empowerment and Family Marie-Thérèse Abena-Ondoa says 1.4% of Cameroonian women are victims of female genital mutilation. But the rate is much higher in the Muslim-dominated communities in the north, where an estimated 20% of women